Despite recent stadium renovations approaching $60 million, the Cotton Bowl Classic will move next year to the brand-new billion-dollar covered Cowboys Stadium. Some have dubbed the new arena Jerry World after Cowboys owner Jerry Jones, who lured the Cotton Bowl away. The name will stay with the game despite the move to Arlington 20 miles away. Meanwhile, Dallas officials hope to fill the old, storied stadium with some other college match. Bowl officials feel the new venue might restore the College Bowl contest to top-tier status that it used to have. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
For the third time, Peyton Manning of the Indianapolis Colts is the Associated Press's NFL Most Valuable Player. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Baruz, Champagne, Cannon Farm, Camargo, Casey Summers, Mattoon, The Andersons, Champagne, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about the life of a man who may well be one of the least well-known of America's founders, Thomas Paine. And our guest for the program is Craig Nelson. He's the author of a recently published biography titled Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations. It's published by the Viking Press, and I believe it came out officially last fall, I believe, and September. In the book, Craig Nelson writes this of Tom Paine. He was the author of the three biggest bestsellers of the 18th century. In his lifetime, he was considered on an intellectual par with the giants of his century. He was someone who clearly had charm, style, and intelligence that others found overpoweringly attractive. At the same time, there were other people who found him to be abrasive and egotistical. And for centuries after his death, Paine was remembered by many as a filthy, poverty-stricken, drunken, wastrel, and unoriginal thinker, an image that was engineered by his great enemies, among them John Adams. We'll talk about this man of great contradiction this morning, Tom Paine, with Craig Nelson. Mr. Nelson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
You bet.
It certainly does seem that, throughout history, I suppose you can find important, influential people who were people of great contradictions. I think that Thomas Paine, you certainly could say that of him. In fact, I'm not sure when the last time I came across someone who did seem to be such a person of such great contradictions. If you look at his background, his early years, what he achieved in his life, what he did, what people thought of him, both those who thought that he was great and those who thought that he was not, it may in fact be something of an understatement to say he was a man of great contradictions.
Well, I found it took me 5 years to do this book, and I found this paradox of his life so compelling because, you know, here's someone who comes from really the lower third of the English social strata. He's a failure in everything he tries to do. He's a working-class, impoverished man whose first wife dies and second wife divorces him and really spends the first 37 years of his life pretty much failing. And then he comes to America and reinvents himself, becomes this tremendous success, writes, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." He and his friends do that. It's an astounding story, and then he sort of dies in ignominy and poverty, and his reputation is destroyed. It's wild.
Yeah. Well, there, you certainly put yourself on one of the things that certainly strikes me, and that is just as you say, Paine is born and lives the first 37 years of his life in England, and he comes to the United States at 37, and you take a look at what his life had been like before that, and you talked about the fact that he was, not particularly successful in business, was a government functionary, was a tax collector, essentially, was not particularly successful in anything that he did. And then if you look at what he did after he came to the United States, you almost have to ask the question, could this possibly be the same man?
Absolutely. It really is the question of finding the job that's right for you, or there was that old book, Do What You Love and the Money Will Follow. Anyway, after trying all these different things in England, suddenly he's offered the job of magazine editor out of the blue here in America, and after being here just a couple of months, and that saves him. It literally transforms him overnight. He's a tremendous success. He meets what he considers to be his intellectual peers, and that's what does it.
Mm-hmm. One of the advantages that perhaps he came, maybe the only advantage he came, the obvious one that he came to the United States with, was that he had come to the attention of Benjamin Franklin, and so he had, in a sense, a letter of recommendation signed by Franklin. How did he meet Franklin?
Well, that's a very long story. For radio purposes, I'll break it down and to say that the one great moment of Paine's first 37 years was when he worked as a buccaneer during the Seven Years' War, and he was able to spend 2 years in London as a man of 20 years old doing anything he wanted. And what he wanted to do was educate himself into the Enlightenment, which was the 200-year-old history of the Renaissance sort of finally coming to fruit. And he educated himself in Newton and Locke and Montesquieu and Hobbes and all the people of the Enlightenment figures of that time. And he did such a great job of it that he started becoming very impressive to his social betters, one of whom was Franklin.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, perhaps his great gift, perhaps his contribution to the revolution was the fact that he had a talent for taking some of the most important ideas, philosophical, political ideas of his time, and presenting those in a way that made them very accessible to almost anybody. And that was the thing that some of his peers admired. And perhaps if you look at men like John Adams, I think actually Adams was jealous. He was jealous of Paine's ability to communicate these ideas. Where did that, not only where, how did he manage to absorb them, but where did that ability, do you think, to in such a commanding, dramatic, and yet accessible way to communicate that, where did it come from?
Well, I believe that it came from years that he spent in a town called Lewes, which was sort of a hotbed of anti-royalty. For hundreds of years, it had been a leading part of the Puritan Civil War, and he was part of a debating club. And I think his writing stemmed directly from his debating. And, in modern times, it's very common for us to say, when you write, make it sound like you're talking. But 200 years ago, that was not so common, and that's what Paine did. He wrote almost exactly, probably, the way he spoke. And especially for people who were illiterate and had his work read aloud to them, this made his ideas all the more compelling.
Mm-hmm. How did he come to write Common Sense?
He actually was sort of one of those converts who becomes more of a follower than any of the original people, in that he comes to America, and right as he arrives, Lexington and Concord are happening. So all of a sudden, the entire society is upset, and things are really at a boiling point. And because of his magazine editorship, he's now debating in Lewes. He was debating with mostly a bunch of fellow working class people, but in Philadelphia, he's meeting Rittenhouse and Benjamin Rush and sort of all the high society types because of his Franklin letters. And he sort of takes all of their ideas and goes one step beyond them. in writing Common Sense and telling America that they don't need a king, and it was time for them to go it alone, and they were going to be the future of the world.
Mm. I think that it's the case that later, as the some of the first histories of the revolution were written, he was essentially written out, and other people were they seemed actively to want to dismiss his importance. But certainly at the time, many people were very moved by what he had written. Certainly George Washington was someone who was very moved by his written. And as I said, I think that even someone like John Adams acknowledged how important it was, although he was irked probably that somebody else was the author of that. Just how important for driving the revolution, for really getting it started, was Paine in his writing?
Well, the first thing he did with Common Sense was, at that time, no one called themselves Americans. America was a term that meant the same thing as hillbilly. People called themselves New Yorkers or Pennsylvanians. And Common Sense convinced everyone that all along the strip of territory, then known as the United Colonies, that they all had something in common. And this was the need for them to have their own government and create their own nation. So what this did was you had a group of people sitting on the fence about this idea, and it pushed everyone over the fence, and it directly led to the Articles of Confederation, and it directly led to the Declaration of Independence, all of which Paine outlined in Common Sense.
Mm. And he also, in addition to being a writer, he also served in the Continental Army?
Yes, he did. He immediately volunteered for the Army and very quickly was told that it would be better if he were writing instead of shooting. So he returned to Philadelphia, but he became one of the great supporters of Washington. He became Washington's great press propagandist and wrote something called The American Crises, a series of 13 essays, the first of which begins, "These are the times that try men's souls."
Mm-hmm. And this was the one, this just seems like a remarkable story, the kind of thing that you can conjure up the vision and you say, this is almost too filmic. And yet it did indeed happen that before, in the preparation for crossing the Delaware, George Washington had that read to his soldiers.
Yes, Washington and his army had suffered one terrible catastrophe after the next. They were losing everything, and the soldiers were not renewing their contracts. And it's Christmas, and Washington needs this sort of coup de théâtre in his war in order to turn public opinion around. And Paine rushes out this little pamphlet explaining why the American cause should not be abandoned. Washington has it read to his soldiers in the middle of the night. And as they cross the Delaware and enter the town of Trenton and taking it over from the Hessians that were guarding it, as they were using their bayonets, they said, "These are the times that try men's souls." So that's how inspiring Paine was for them.
Yeah, apparently he also, not only was he generous with his time, with his energy, with what money he had, and he wasn't, at least at this point, he certainly wouldn't have been a wealthy man, he put the money that he made from Common Sense, which actually was, again, you have to consider the fact that, how many copies were sold, how many people there were. It clearly was early America's biggest selling publication. The money that he made out of that, he put it into the revolution.
Yes, he had it donated for mittens for the army, but also he pulled it out of his profits so that the book could be priced as little as possible and get it into as many hands as possible, which a number of people think was the first idea now being used in the internet, that you give something away to get people to buy something else.
How many copies of Common Sense were printed?
Well, we don't really know exactly, because the United States had no copyright at that time. So once you noticed that something was popular, everybody started printing it. But it was believed that it was read by a third of the population. So if you were printing it today, you would say that it sold 35 million copies today to get a proportionate number.
That's just stunning. That's a truly stunning number.
I think that's a 7 times Da Vinci Code, I believe, or Harry Potter, I think.
Our guest, maybe I should introduce again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Craig Nelson. He is the author of a recent, fairly recently published biography of Thomas Paine. The book is Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations. It's published by Viking, was published last September. He's the author of 4 previous books. His writings have appeared in Salon, the New England Review, Blender, Genre, a host of other publications. He was an editor at HarperCollins, Hyperion, Random House for almost 20 years, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. Certainly, if you're interested in reading about Tom Paine, you can head down to the bookstore or the library and look for the book. And on the program here, questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about, give us some kind of understanding about what Thomas Paine was like as a man, or at least you could talk about what people said, because as I said at the beginning, he seemed to prompt people to extreme kinds of reactions, because there were people who thought that he was charming and attractive, and that there were other people who thought that he was about the lowest form of life there was. Why did people have such an extreme kind of reaction to him?
Well, my feeling is that there were 2 things going on. First of all, everyone knew that he came from this working class background. So there was a sort of class snobbery going on, especially in England, but also in America still, a feeling that who does this guy think he is to tell us about these ideas and the way government should be run? He should go back to making corsets, because he was originally taught to make these women undergarments called stays that look like something Madonna would wear today. But anyway, so there was a class snobbery, but also I think that he behaved very differently among people he admired and among those he didn't. I think he was very ingratiating and charming and savvy with Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, James Monroe, all of his American friends, and then not so much with the people who he considered his political foes, meaning John Jay, Gouverneur Morris, eventually John Adams, although they started off as friends. Mm-hmm. So I think he actually behaved, was almost seemed like 2 different people. That's the only way I can understand it myself.
Well, what for those people who were counted among his enemies, what? And I've talked a couple of times about one of them being John Adams, and this may be a great oversimplification and an injustice to John Adams, but it did seem as if John Adams was a little bit jealous.
He was jealous of everyone, and so but he especially, I think, took it out on Paine, because I think he felt that Paine didn't think through his ideas enough in the way that John Adams would prefer. Paine did think he thought through his ideas enough, and Adams did not. So that became a big focus. Plus, Adams had this enormous feud with Franklin, and Paine was Franklin's sort of he called him his adopted political son. So at moments when Adams couldn't take out his rancor on Franklin, he took it out on Paine.
Mm. Did Paine feel that he had not gotten the kind of credit, acknowledgement, appreciation that he was due for his contribution to the revolution?
Absolutely. He was immensely bitter. And literally, even after he was rewarded by Congress and a number of the state assemblies, he still was bitter and had to leave the country. And so what he decided to do is he decided he was going to give up writing and design bridges, which seems like a bizarre thing to us today. But in fact, during the Enlightenment era, a Renaissance man was someone who did everything, so it wasn't that strange to them.
Yeah, and that, I suppose in a way that does make you think a little bit about Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, people like that who were polymaths. They were interested in a lot of different things. They had talents and skills in a lot of different areas. And Paine maybe wouldn't quite equal the stature of them, but was in that kind of sense very much a one of these kinds of men, and in that respect, perhaps certainly a man of his, an exceptional man of his time.
Yes.
We have some callers here we'd like to bring in the conversation. And people who are listening certainly can call in, make comments, ask questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We will start with someone in Champaign, and this caller is line one.
Hi. Yeah.
Yes, hi.
If I'm not mistaken, Thomas Paine, in his Rights of Man, introduced the idea of Social Security.
Well, yes, you're right. It became he introduced it to the mass public. It actually was an idea that many people were talking about at the time.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
I thought he was the original one.
Well, one of the points I was tried to make in my book is that he has this reputation for being this radical, left-wing, rabble-rousing, revolutionary, wild, crazy guy. But in fact, almost anything in his writings were mainstream. So I was able to track down how both Adam Smith and Rousseau, who are about as politically opposite as you can get in the 18th century, both had welfare proposals. Social Security and welfare proposals.
Surprisingly, I think Teddy Roosevelt also introduced it in one of his inaugural addresses, too.
Yes, it was a continuing problem at that time when to see the disparity between rich and poor that was so common in Europe now becoming common in America. So it became more and more popular, but because Paine's books were so popular, it became a topic of wide discussion after he wrote about it in Rights of Man, Part 2.
Well, thank you. It's thank
you. All right. Well, thank you for the call. Other people, if you have questions, certainly you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He did indeed have an interesting set of ideas. As you mentioned, he was maybe not the first one to propose this, but in a public way talked about the idea of old age pensions. He is an opponent of slavery. He was certainly an opponent of a big government. He was a proponent of democracy. And for that reason, it seems that throughout time, even though he has had detractors, there have been a number of people who have embraced his ideas. And interestingly enough, there have been people who have counted him as a kind of a hero, who have been all the way along the political spectrum. It's as almost as if you can find, almost anybody can find something in Paine to grab onto.
Yes, well, for many years he was considered a cornerstone of progressive politics, and then he sort of got rediscovered by the more right-wing late in life. He became especially popular with Reagan and Ronald Reagan speechwriters, and so I guess that's part of my I'm actually thrilled for anyone to find a predecessor in Paine, because I feel he's so unacknowledged and his reputation was so besmirched that I'm glad he's coming back.
Yeah. Well, is the reason that his contribution wasn't acknowledged simply that there were people who didn't like him, who resented him, who in an active sort of a way worked to besmirch his memory, his reputation, his contribution in the years after his death?
Yes, there were three things that happened. The first was that he never really, you know, he didn't become president, he didn't become a congressman, he didn't become a governor. He never really took part in governing the United States like the other key founding fathers did. So that lowered his reputation in that way as far as being a founding father. Then, because he took part in the French Revolution, he was tarnished with the excesses of the French Revolution, even though he himself fought against Robespierre and argued to not execute Louis XVI. So there was that. And then finally, he made a number of enemies at the end of his life, and a number of very religious people were upset by his religious writing, and that besmirched his reputation. So the combination of all three sort of brought him down.
Yeah, several things that we could talk a little bit more. Let me just pick one. One individual who early on, I think, was an admirer of Paine and his writing was George Washington. They, though, then later had an extreme kind of falling out. What happened between Paine and Washington?
Well, it's a very sad story. What happened was that Paine ends up being elected to the French Assembly, where he is helping them to write their new constitution. And during this time, he falls in with a group known as the Girondins or the Brissotines, who are purged out of power. And he ends up getting thrown in jail as well, when Robespierre rises to power. And the American minister in Paris at that time is one of his long-standing love-hate enemies, Gouverneur Morris. And Morris tells the United States that he's doing everything he can to help Tom Paine while doing nothing at all. And Paine, when he finally gets out of prison after almost a year, almost entirely a broken man, blames George Washington, under whose presidency he was imprisoned, for not paying attention to this, and develops this tremendous sort of scapegoat rancor towards Washington, and writes an article trashing Washington, which is published in America by another Washington foe, who was Benjamin Franklin's grandson, and this sort of hurts Paine's reputation with the Federalists and with the pro-Washington faction.
Mm-hmm. This chapter of his involvement in the French Revolution is like everything here that we've talked about, is really interesting. As you say, he was a supporter of the Revolution. He was actually at a time when it was possible for someone who was not French to be a member of the French Assembly. He was, even though he didn't speak French. He kind of got into trouble in part because, as you say, he argued against the execution of the king. He said, well, what you really should do with the king instead of executing him, you should send him, you should exile him to America, where he would learn a few things about, you know, about democracy and freedom and government, right, and the rights of the people and the rights of the governed and all that. The one thing that you didn't mention is that then when he was imprisoned, he actually came very close, maybe within a couple of days, of going to the guillotine.
Yes, it's an incredible story. Paine came down with a typhus fever, and he shared a cell with three roommates. And the roommates were able to convince the prison authorities to leave their door open so the breeze might come in and alleviate some of his fever. And the authorities did this. And while the door was open, the guy came by to mark up the doors for who was going to go to the guillotine that night. And he marked the door that was for Paine and all of his cellmates. And the cellmates then said to the prison authorities, oh, he's doing much better. We can close the door now. And they did. And then the guy coming by with the tumbrel picking up the people didn't see the chalk mark. And a couple of days later, Robespierre fell from power and it saved Paine's life. So it doesn't seem like a plausible story, but it certainly is incredible. And I hope it's true. Paine says it's true.
Well, it certainly makes a good story.
Yeah,
that's for sure, and that it does. Indeed, it was for him a narrow kind of a thing, because he could have ended up dying in prison. He could have ended up being executed instead of eventually, as was the case, coming back to the United States. I realize we're kind of jumping around here. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about how the circumstances under which he left the United States after the Revolution. He left the United States and he went back to England, where he had been born. Why did he decide to leave America? Why did he decide to go back to England?
Well, I think he was terribly bitter at how he had been treated at the end of the Revolution, that people like Robert Morris had made a fortune, and pretty much he and actually Samuel Adams were sort of the two people that had been left out in the cold by what had happened during the war years. And I think he was really enraged, and he was someone who who could be self-pitying. So he really turned against the United States in a certain way, and decided to leave. And he had visited Benjamin Franklin during a trip to try and get more money out of Louis XVI, and had been treated as a literary superstar in Europe, and probably enjoyed it very much, and was thinking of that when he decided to go back to England to visit his mother. His father had died. And while he was there, he was sort of hosted by all the sort of anti-monarchist groups, the Whigs at that time, one of whom was Edmund Burke, and he became very close friends with Burke and the other Whigs. And at the same time, his friend Lafayette, who he had known during the American Revolution in Philadelphia, was now running the government of France in something of a constitutional monarchy. So you see Paine hopping back and forth constantly between London and Paris, sort of having the time of his life. It's a really great period for him.
Yeah. And this was when he went back to England. This was when he started writing The Rights of Man, in which he was preaching. It was, in a sense, kind of the same sermon as Common Sense, and that I think a lot of people there in Britain resonated with that, but many others didn't. And he became persona non grata, and I think at one point he actually had to leave Britain to escape being being put in jail.
Absolutely. He becomes upset that people in England are complaining about the course of the French Revolution. And it was sort of funny that they were complaining, because at that moment, what Lafayette was doing with the king wasn't all that different from the government of England with the parliament. And so he decides to write a book explaining why the American form of government was much better than having a king and a parliament of lords. And this becomes Rights of Man. And one of the great ironies of our own history is that if American school children read anything of Paine, they read Common Sense, because it was so historically significant in the course of the Revolution. But his real American book is Rights of Man, which explains to Europe what had happened in America and why they should have a nice government like ours. And this book becomes so popular that people start demanding constitutional reform in England. And between watching the course of the French Revolution and think it's going to come infect them, and seeing the popularity of Paine, the English government loses their minds, more or less, and accuses him of sedition and drives him out of the country.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, as we said, he goes to France, and in fact, he kind of had to. He couldn't stay in England. Once he was in France, he really couldn't go back to England. He also was kind of stuck, because he was afraid, apparently, that even if he tried to go back to the United States, if he would happen to encounter a British warship, that he could be arrested and hauled back to England. So he was rather stuck. He did, however, have this commitment to the French Revolution, and they made him an honorary French citizen. He was elected to the National Assembly, even though he couldn't speak French. And as we've talked about, he got himself into trouble because he argued against the execution of Louis. Did he really not know how problematic that was, and what sort of a position he was putting himself into at that time, making taking that kind of stand?
Well, I think one of the things that people who didn't like Thomas Paine didn't like about him was that he could be sanctimonious, and he could get a bee in his bonnet and pursue it no matter what, you know. He didn't really, when he attacked George Washington at the end of his life, he didn't really have any evidence for doing this. But he was convinced that the French would have their reputations terribly hurt if they executed Louis XVI, and he turned out to be right. It was sort of the beginning of the Great War that brought in Napoleon and the end of the French Revolution in a certain way, that period. So he was correct in that, but of course it was politically absolutely the wrong thing to say, and he ended up being branded as this menace to the government and thrown in prison.
Yeah. You talked about the fact that just how lucky he was to escape being executed, and the fact that he was very bitter. He was angry with the government of the United States, with George Washington, with the American ambassador to France, who Paine felt didn't do anything for him. What do we know about what the government of the United States, George Washington, Governor Morris, who was the ambassador, anybody else, thought about Paine and his situation? Did they, in fact, do anything to try to help him? Or did they really say, well, we really don't care what happens to old Tom?
Well, I have a theory, and I don't have the paper to prove it, so it's sort of like a little bit squeamish kind of a theory. But my theory is that Washington was in the middle of beginning to negotiate the Jay Treaty to end the simmering problems he was having with England, who was still the most powerful military force in the world, and was causing lots of trouble for the fledgling United States, which was probably the least powerful military force in the world. And if there was an American that the English government did not care for, it was Thomas Paine. So I think it was to the government's benefit in negotiating the Jay Treaty to have him in prison and shut up that way.
Mm.
And that's why I think he was allowed to stay there.
Let me again just introduce very quickly our guest, Craig Nelson. He is the author of Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations, biography of Tom Paine. It was published last September. It's published by Viking, and certainly you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome here on the program. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number, so that's for our local folks. But if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, even people listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact, particularly at the beginning, that here we have a man who was full of contradictions, and one involving the French. For a man who was a strident anti-monarchist and proponent of democracy, he also apparently, though, saw something in Napoleon that he liked and was very initially was moved to support Napoleon, although I think then actually later he did a 180 on Napoleon. What exactly were his feelings about Napoleon?
Well, originally he felt, I guess like everyone in France did, that Napoleon really had saved the nation. And so he sort of followed along with that, and he thought that Napoleon was going to bring democracy and republican government to despots and overthrow tyrants, especially tyrant George III in England. And a funny thing happened when this book came out, where a writer in the Wall Street Journal said, well, because Paine supported Napoleon's invasion of England, surely he would have supported the war in Iraq. But, you know, we don't really do those kinds of things in history. We can't jump those kinds of conclusions. But anyway, he thought Napoleon was going to bring the ideas of America and France to the rest of Europe, and then when he became more of an emperor and less of a president, Paine changed his mind and started publicly saying, criticizing Napoleon, and the government retaliated by making life difficult for his landlord and publisher.
We have, I think, another caller here getting ready to take them. Someone on a cell phone on our toll-free line. We'll go there next. Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting program. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick questions, and since I'm on the cell, I'll go ahead and ring off. David mentioned in the beginning that at the end of his life, he died impoverished and alcoholic and so on and so forth, and I was just wondering if that, in fact, was true, or if that was a vicious rumor put upon by his enemies. And then I was wondering about his, did he leave any offspring? Did he have any children here in America? And if he did anything ever come of them? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thank you.
All right.
Well, he did die sort of he became this sort of lightning rod of controversy. He came back to the United States for his last years because his good friend Thomas Jefferson had been elected president, but he became this sort of focal point of controversy, and he was not allowed to vote at one point in New Rochelle because the town was run by a anti-Paine faction who claimed that he'd renounced his American citizenship during the French Revolution, and he had a very rough final years of his life. But he wasn't an alcoholic. He did like to tie one on every so often. I think he was manic depressive. I think he tried to cure some of his depressions with alcohol, and that led to that reputation. But actually, he died a millionaire because he was left quite a number of acres in New Rochelle, and he was parsimonious, and he saved his pennies so that his heirs, who were not his own children, but the landlord and publisher of his in France, who had taken him in at the end of his life, he made them his heirs. But one of the great tragedies that happened was that all of Paine's papers that he left with this French family who moved to the United States were destroyed in a fire in a warehouse in St. Louis. So when you write about him, you have to sort of pull all these mysteries together, because we actually don't have a lot of documents that would tell us what he was actually thinking about certain something.
Yeah. He was, during the period, his first 37 years he lived in England, he was married twice. His first wife died in childbirth or shortly after giving birth, so he lost his first wife and child. He had a second wife. That was not a successful marriage. They didn't have any children. So he didn't have any children. Was there no, in his life in America or anywhere else, were there no significant women in his life?
As far as we can tell, there weren't. But, you know, everyone says that's impossible. But if there were, he doesn't mention any of them.
Well, other questions certainly are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something that we have not talked about but was significant, and I think it was certainly significant because it was one of those things about pain that people who didn't like him really didn't like. He was attacked for his deism, and that is something that now I think the people I'm not sure I completely understand that. I think now people have a difficulty understanding what exactly that means, what it meant for the time, and it always seems to enter into these discussions we have about the founders and their ideas about religion and what role they thought religion should play in American life. What were his religious views?
Well, he shared the same religion that everyone of his generation who believed in the Enlightenment shared, and I'm talking about everyone from Benjamin Franklin to Robespierre and Napoleon. And it was called deism, and deism was that all these men had been educated in the discoveries of Newton, who showed that underlying the course of the planets was mathematics. And they believed that there must be a great force that had created the system, that there was a first being, so they all believed in God, but they didn't believe that you could go to church, and they didn't believe that God answers prayers, and they didn't believe that he had any agency, but they did believe in providence, and they did believe in the golden rule that you should do well, you should serve God by treating other people well. And finally, they believed that in a Roman idea, they believed in a kind of a form of virtue, where after you made enough money to support your family, you devoted yourself to civic good. And that was how you became famous, and that was how you became known hundreds of years later. And this turned out to be true for them. So that's actually one of the things about Paine and his friends and their religion I wish we could bring back, that you devoted yourself to public good after you made plenty of money.
Mm-hmm. There, among the many remarkable stories about Paine is the story about what happened to his remains after he died. He died in 1809. He was just 59 years old and was buried. But then sometime later, a few years later, an admirer of his decided that he hadn't gotten the recognition that he should have and had his remains dug up and sent back to England. And the idea was that there perhaps he, you know, he would get the recognition he deserves. There would be a big thing. There would be some kind of monument. Apparently, when he did have his funeral here in the United States, only 6 people were in attendance. Tell the story about what happened to Thomas Paine's bones.
Well, it's really, this is actually the reason I first became interested in this story, because one of his great acolytes, William Cobbett, became enraged that Americans weren't treating Paine's memory with the respect he thought it deserved. And 10 years after Paine died, he went to New Rochelle, dug up the body, took it to England, announced he was building this grand memorial for Paine, and the English government said, no, in fact, you aren't going to be doing that. And Cobbett dies bankrupt. And his son tries to have the bones included in the bankruptcy auction, and the auctioneer refuses. So the son marks up the bones and starts like giving them away and selling them, and they sort of pass all over the place. So now there are all these people with Paine bones apparently in their attic, there was a period where the Paine Historic Association in New Rochelle was trying to bring them all back and give him a proper internment, but that failed. They could never get enough money to do that. So he's been scattered to the winds.
Yeah. Is it true that I maybe this is not true, that in the United States there's only one, in all of the United States there's only one statue of Thomas Paine?
As far as I know, yes, there's only one. They're trying to get some more built, but they are all over Europe, so at least he's there.
And there apparently is one in the place where he was born in England.
Yes, there's one of the ugliest statues you've ever seen, which was in gold leaf. With Thomas Paine looking like he's trying to throw his quill at somebody. And it was created in America and sent to his hometown, where it caused incredible controversy, but finally they put it up.
It seems to me that gesture with the quill seems to be, it looks like he's holding it like it was a dart, like he was getting ready to throw it at a dart. But I suppose the idea is making the point about the mightiness of the pen, I guess.
Yes, exactly. But it's sort of ludicrous because it looks like he's about to play darts.
It does. Yes, I you'd think that maybe they could come up with something just slightly more dignified for a pose for Mr. Paine.
Exactly.
It seems that here now in recent years, and at least going back 5 years, maybe more, we have here in the United States had a spate of books about founding fathers. I think one of the reasons that we were really interested and eventually talking with you about Thomas Paine was that he was someone whose role had not maybe been acknowledged to the point that it should. And that obviously was something that was in your mind as well. And the reason that you decided to write the book, because so much has been written about Jefferson and Franklin and Adams and Alexander Hamilton and a lot of other these men, we thought, well, Thomas Paine ought to get at least a mention here. I wonder why it is you think that it is that we seem to be getting so many books about, we're in this period where we're getting so many books about this particular generation of leaders and this particular point period of American history.
Because I think that a generation of readers is realizing that the history they were taught in school isn't quite the whole story of the real history, and now they want to read about it again. So they're interested in books on the American Revolution, on the Civil War, on Lincoln. There's a sort of perennial topics that adult people who like reading serious books of history want to read. But in particular, I think Paine was ignored because the end of his story is somewhat sad in that it shows how America wanted to export its revolution back to the mother continent, and this happened first with the French Revolution. And when the French Revolution failed under Napoleon, and when the George III government under Pitt cracked down, many of the American founding fathers thought they had failed themselves. And really, the letters they write at the end of their lives are just heartbreaking to read, and that sort of is summed up in Paine's life. And of course, we now know that they were wrong to be heartbroken, that almost the majority of the world lives under democratic government with rights of speech and rights of a religion and rights of assembly, and all the things that they were hoping to achieve is now almost the majority of the world lives with that kind of system. So they were a little short-sighted in their grief.
Yeah. I think it is interesting, too, that it seems that we do have a sincere desire, perhaps not only to get a better understanding of this history than we got when we were coming up in school, but perhaps also to try and see these men, and they were men, as real people, getting beyond the marble statues and the bronze statues and the formal paintings, those images of them, and then that kind of two-dimensional grade school kind of version of American history that we all got, that it seems that we really want to, in part what we want is to try as much as we can to get a feeling for who they were as living, breathing human beings.
Yes, to get beyond the marble statuary and the horrible pictures on the money. I actually think the George Washington Pitt portrait on the dollar bill is the worst thing Americans have ever done to him, because in real life, Washington was so vigorous and commanding and avant-garde and progressive and radical a figure, and now he's this thin-lipped, please go away, I have a headache picture on the dollar bill. It's too bad.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's interesting relatively recently some significant resources and technology were dedicated by the folks there who maintain his house to actually develop some models based on everything that they could determine to actually show what George Washington really looked like at various points of his life, particularly when he was a younger man, who he certainly was. He, for his time, he was a very tall man. He was robust. He was athletic. I don't know if you would call him handsome, but he certainly was not that guy that you're talking about with the wooden teeth.
Exactly.
That's on the money, or that it's in the Gilbert Stuart kind of paintings that we have.
Yes, well, those were at the end of his life, and maybe, you know, that's what he looked like because he was in pain with his teeth or something like that. But there are numerous letters we have describing how awestruck people are when Washington enters their presence and how commanding he was and how he had a more regal bearing than any king in all of Europe. And these are from people, some of these are from people who didn't like him very much and didn't think he should be president or head of the army. So mm-hmm. he really must have had a sway.
Hmm. So it was just going back a step. So it was indeed that story about Tom Paine's bones that got you interested in trying to find out about
it. Well, I thought, well, why did this little person who I thought was a historic footnote, what was he that his bones were dug up? And I was just flabbergasted by hearing about all this. And then when I found out that his life covers the Enlightenment, the American and the French, and in England, the Industrial Revolution, you saw this huge sweep of history through the life of this one man, I thought, oh, I've got to do this.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the point here where we pretty much have to finish up. Maybe we have about a minute or so left, and we've gone at a sprint here through the man's life, so that there is, if people would like to take a more leisurely stroll, they can take a look at the book. What is it that you would like people to come away with and to know about Thomas Paine?
Well, Paine believed that government rose from its citizens. And I think what he would be upset about if he came back to the earth now would be that too many people have given up on government, that they either don't vote or they're unhappy about something and they don't do anything about it. And he thinks that citizens should be engaged in the political process. So, in common sense, he wrote, we have it in our power to begin the world over again, and he and his friends did that, and if they can do it, why can't you?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you giving some of your time, and certainly would suggest to people that they take a look at the book, Thomas Paine, Enlightenment, Revolution, and the Birth of Modern Nations, by our guest, Craig Nelson. It's published by Viking. And Mr. Nelson, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
It's 3 minutes before noon. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Afternoon Magazine gets underway at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Coming up at 1:06 this afternoon, we'll rebroadcast an interview with writer Kate Summerscale, author of The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, a shocking murder and the undoing of a great Victorian detective. That will follow the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening in Kansas City and in Chicago on the first trading day of 2009. March wheat in Kansas City trading at 625, down 5. May 642, up 3 quarters. March wheat 601, down 9 and 3 quarters. May 614 and a half, down 9. March corn 406, down 1. May 417, down 3 quarters. July 426.5, down 1.5. September 440.5, up 2.5. January soybeans 973, up 3/4. March 976.5, down 3.5. May 992.5, up 1. July $10.06, that is up 3.75. January soybean meal 303.60, up 3.10. January oil 33.77, up 48. At the market in Chicago, February live cattle 88.30, up 2.25. April 91.30, up 2.20. January feeder cattle 96.15, up 2.10. March 96.20, up 2.52.5. February lean hog 63.87.5, up $3. Outside markets, February crude 46.05, up 1.45. The U.S. dollar 81.49, up 34. The CRB index 231.33, up 179. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 154 points at 89.31. The NASDAQ up 33 points at 16.10. The S&P 500 up 17 points at 9.20. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, partly sunny, highs ranging from 22 in far northwestern Illinois to near 50 in southern Illinois. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny, the high around 40, the wind from the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. 35 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois at noon Central Time. Mike will have more on the weather at 12:35. Also this afternoon, we're happy